Hi everyone, welcome to the Sunlight Media Podcast. I'm your host, Angelo Frasina, founder and CEO of Sunlight Media. Today's guest is Grammy Award-winning sound engineer and music producer, Chris Tech O'Ryan.
Tech, how you doing, my friend?
Good, mate. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. Thanks again for joining us on the podcast today. I know there's some crazy stuff going on around our city of LA this week, and everyone's kind of on edge, and I'm sure you are too. How are you feeling amongst all the mayhem?
It's a sad state of affairs. I mean, racism has been reached a tipping point over here, you know, with good reason. There's systemic cop, you know, violence and brutality, and I don't know whether it comes from, you know, maybe it's part A, systemic racism, or bad training, or both. Or, I mean, I couldn't believe, you know, seeing that police officer kneel on George Floyd's neck. Like, it's sad to see, and you know, the looting, you know, the rioting is boiled over into looting, but you know, the looters and the rioters need to be kept separate. There's obviously the looters are people taking advantage of the situation and not fighting for the cause, and so, you know, that's a shame to see the looters lumped in with the protesters and to hurt the protesters' cause.
Yeah, it's sad. Hopefully it gets under control soon and everyone can go about their normal life. And at the same time, we obviously want to see justice for, you know, George Floyd and his family. And hopefully that gets resolved sooner than later. But, yeah, today's podcast, we want to get into a little bit more positive stuff. Discuss your music career. A very well established engineer and music producer here in LA. Before we go into that, I'd like to talk a little bit about the early days, some of your early, you know, childhood interest in music, how you got involved, and kind of how that came about.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I always wanted to be a musician ever since I was a little kid, and started like choir at 7 or 8 years old, piano at 9, guitar at 12, and always wrote music, always, as soon as I was kind of, maybe I was born to be a sound engineer, in the fact that when I was young, I was always thinking, why does this song sound better than this other song? And then as soon as I got a computer, I was, back in the day, this would have been 94 or something, I was running tracker programs, which are like kind of these very basic sampling kind of things, kind of programs, and then also recording when I could. Of course, I could like record 2 or 3 tracks, not like we can these days where you can get a DAW for free that'll, you know, do as much as you need. So it was a different time, but always studied music. And then I was fortunate to go to a good school and to you know, be exposed to a very wide range of music styles and everything. So I, you know, I played brass in the band and played upright bass in the jazz quartet and what else, percussion in orchestra. And I was also in the Australian Opera for a season as well. So I just had a very well-rounded education. And then I got into Box Hill College of Music, and I was doing about a year and a half there. And then the band I was in sort of got signed to a sort of a label that was run by a conman that ripped off a lot of Aussies, and then he left, and I think he's in Singapore now or something. And then so I quit music college to do the band full time, and which with the music school is really good, by the way. Like, that gave me also a perspective, being surrounded by all these great players and different styles. And I didn't study sound engineering a little bit, but it was more the technical stuff. It was more about sound engineering theory and stuff, which is really, you know, you need to have a basic grounding in that, and study some composition and film scoring. And then I quit that, and then about a year and a half in, I should have finished it, but anyway, quit that, and then did the band full time. Then the band broke up, and so then a few friends were going to LA, and they were like a boy band, so I was like, okay, I'll go to LA then. Sold my car and came over here and basically started from scratch, and started sort of interning at studios and working for free and living off no money and all the rest. And, you know, finally started to get paid and I think coming from Australia, I kind of had, like in reality, when I look back, I was kind of, you know, even for a new guy demanding $15 an hour, and I guess, you know, they paid me, but looking back now, that's even like a lot of money for an unskilled, you know, kind of a work without a degree. Now I didn't even know what the minimum wage was so low back then. I was kind of naive when I went to LA, but you know, I just fought my way up. I basically did every song that I did. I, you know, treated it like, you know, it was a representation of my skill. And so I never let, you know, anything go past me. It's like, you know, even if you're working on a song and you've been working on it since, you know, 2 p.m. and it's 5 o'clock in the morning and you just want to get it done, but you hear something, you go to bounce it and then you hear, oh, that hi-hat's too loud. You know, you go back and you turn it down and these sort of things that you do, like just going above and beyond and sort of treating every song like it was, yeah, like it was a mark of my career. And then, you know, just backing that up with being with good business ethics and just, you know, making sure that, you know, all the producers and everyone's happy. You don't need to, you know, you don't want to, you sort of have to realize like how important it is on their side as well when they're hiring you and how professional you have to be. So professionalism,
yep,
like counts for so much because they're, you know, they're counting on you. So, you know, you're on time to the studio, you know, it's always early. You know, you work hard, you don't complain. You know, just all these good things that we get told growing up about any work environment really applies to music and sound engineering. And I think that gets a little bit distorted sometimes because people see, you know, the media portrays the music industry as like everyone's smoking weed and like lazy and like everyone's cool and shit like that. But it's really about the work. I mean, if a producer or a label...
It's about professionalism. It's about professionalism and making sure that you're doing your job and what it's expected of your job, basically. But if we can backtrack just a little more before we get into the LA stuff, and yeah. I've noticed you mentioned that, you know, you played a lot of instruments in the early days. Did music just kind of come naturally? Would you pick something up and you'd immediately be able to play something and you learn advanced things relatively easy? I mean, how did it come about, you know, you playing so many instruments at an early age?
I had a talent for it, but I definitely wasn't the most talented even in my class. Like my mate was way better at me than everything he touched, guitar and composition and everything like that. And but I think with me, I think talent is, you do have to have a talent for things. Someone asked me that similar kind of question the other day, and I was thinking about it, and I was thinking back to, like, the question is, if you're going to pursue something, do you have a talent for it? And how do you even know you have a talent? Because there's no really sort of discernible, like, level. So it's someone could be saying, well, I think I'm pretty good. Like, for me, I had something that I thought about that when I was 12, we had a school musical and we had about 10 songs or whatever. And I taught myself how to play all the songs on piano on just by ear. And so I was thinking, so that was something that gave me sort of like a kick that, like, okay, maybe I am, you know, good enough to do this. But like I said, I wasn't the best player in my class. I wasn't, you know, I think talent is like, what do they say? 1%, Einstein say 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. So you need a talent for something, but it's more about working hard at it. And, you know, most of my work now is vocal production and tuning. So in vocal production, I really have to take the song to, you know, the next level in terms of the vocals. And so a lot of producers and record labels will, even though they could record the artist themselves, they give it to me to make sure it comes out, you know, as good as it can. And that's a skill that, like even maybe 10 years ago, I wouldn't be able to just listen to a song and just harmonize with it straight away. And now, because of vocal production, because I have to be able to do that and sing, you know, tell the artist, okay, sing this note, blah, blah, blah. Now I can do that and I can sing the, you know, the low harmony and sing the top harmony just off my head, just listening and singing along. But, and so someone would interpret that as talent, like, wow, look how talented he is. But I couldn't do that 10 years ago. So it's kind of more of a learned skill than a talent, you know, in my opinion. Right.
Yeah, I think everyone's talent improves the more you learn, right? Talent also comes with training and experience too, right?
I think what we call talent is your brain developed in a certain aspect, and I think some people are more developed with that naturally, and then some people have to develop their brain to that. So, you know, I don't think sound engineering and music is something that you'd be really good at if you have no talent for it. Like, you know, I can't really draw or paint, and I could take lessons and to become a better painter or a better drawer, but I don't think I'd ever be a great, you know, drawing artist.
You can also, I think, define talent as, you know, the ability to learn, you know, having a good work ethic and having a passion and an ability to learn and a perseverance to get better at it, I think is a way to define talent as well.
Learning what you need to learn, that's kind of a hard skill, like kind of to take a step back and to say, okay, what do I need to get better at and what do I need to learn, and then sort of focusing on that, because you know identifying your weaknesses basically.
Right. So in your early days as a professional musician in Melbourne, what was your primary instrument? Did you kind of bounce around between guitar, piano, vocals, or did you just kind of focus on one thing when you were a working musician?
It was mainly guitar and you know, synths and stuff, but I was never really professional back in Australia. That really didn't start until I came over here and to LA and, you know, needed to pay the bills. And so I came over with the intention of always being a producer and a writer, but the engineering was a way to pay the bills. That's why I got into that. And that kind of took on its own thing. I didn't know that you could have such a career being a sound engineer either. You know, a very fulfilling career. Very creatively fulfilling as well. So
what was the decision behind moving to LA? I know you mentioned that you had a boy band or something that was moving here. Was that kind of the primary decision, or was it a bit of an individual kind of passion as well?
It was really the band I was in broke up, and I was like, okay, what am I going to do? I was feeling a bit lost, and the guys were like, well, we're in LA, why don't you just come over? And I was like, all right. So I came over and played guitar for them for their auditions and stuff like that. And it was a pretty fun time. You know, there was like six of us living in a one bedroom apartment. And as everyone does in LA. And we did some cool stuff. Like in the first 6 months we met with Usher and Dr. Dre and you know, a lot of really good producers and stuff. And which is the cool thing about LA is like you got to go where the action is, and you run into people, like, and if you've got some talent, it's kind of like, I hate when people say it's not what you know, it's who you know. It's not really true. I mean, everyone comes from somewhere, and you know, nepotism only goes so far. If your uncle's owns a record label, sure, you might be able to, you know, get in and get some work done, but you're not going to become LA Reid, you know. So that's the thing about LA is people saw some talent and they recognized some talent, and we, you know, someone hears you sing, go, wow, these guys are really good. Let me take them to this guy. And this guy goes like, oh, well, let me take them to Usher. And then sure enough, we're, you know, playing in front of Usher, and Usher's like, man, this is cool. It's really cool. So, they didn't get a deal, and they ended up going back, and I stayed basically.
So the entire band was from Melbourne originally? The entire band that was based here in LA was from Melbourne originally?
Yeah, exactly. And then and after they went back, about 6 months later, I flew the lead singer of the band back, and he lived with me and my wife, who was girlfriend at the time. And we started working on his project, and we got a deal with Bad Boy, with got flown to New York and played for Puffy and did a, you know, half a mil deal with Bad Boy. And then this artist couldn't handle the slog of, the reality of, okay, now you got your deal, but you're not driving a Porsche. Now you got your deal, you got your budget, but you need to get in the studio and make a million songs and make a great album. And so we spent like a year and a half just working and working, probably made, 80 to 90 really solid, great songs. The first one we did actually ended up on a Tyler Perry soundtrack, and it got there so quickly. We recorded the song. Great song. Someone heard it. We took it to someone who took it to someone. Within about a month, it was on Kevin Lyle's desk, who's was the CEO of Warner Music at the time. And then he took it to Puffy, and then Puffy signed it, and that song ended up on the soundtrack. It's called Brown Eyed Blues. But, that's just on the strength of the song. It's such a great song that it, you know, did all that for us. But this artist couldn't really handle the reality of it and went back to Australia. And that was, so that was 3 years of hard work gone down the drain. It was kind of depressing, especially when, you know, we paid for every single thing, all his food, everything he did. He lived with us. You know, he wasn't allowed to work being on an artist visa. And so we paid for everything and did all this work. And then he was like, nah, sir, I'm going back home. Don't care about this. And so that, you know, made me a bit depressed for a bit. And then I went back into sound engineering, and that's when Tricky Stewart, who wrote Umbrella and Single Ladies, a lot of big songs, he had Umbrella blow up, and then he was like, okay, we're getting the band back together. And so then I, you know, did a lot of cool projects with Tricky, like Usher and Mariah Carey and stuff like that, and then Mary J. Blige, and won a Grammy on that album, and then just kept focusing in on, you know, more vocal production and mixing and production and everything like that, and since signed a young Aussie kid called Black Summer. He's just turned 17, producer, so I've been working the last, you know, couple of years on his project. So it's
That's cool.
18 years in the making, I guess.
Wow, that's a long time. I think you've been here a year longer than me, so we're kind of in the living a parallel life almost.
Right.
So your early days as an intern, which particular studios did you approach? Did you just kind of, you know, pick up the book and say, oh, I'd love to work at this place or at that place? Or did you kind of reach out to your connections and say, hey, can I come and intern for you guys? How did that all come about?
I didn't have any connections basically. But the beautiful thing again, like about living in LA is that, you know, just living in Studio City, there's people that are artists and labels and stuff like that. So we were living in the same apartment complex as B2K. And I just, you know, wanted to be like, can I just engineer and intern there? And, you know, I just showed up and started learning there. I mean, I'd been on Pro Tools since, you know, way back, but I hadn't had that much experience on it in Australia. But it was just sort of... just met them because of the proximity, really. I know, and I think back in the day it wasn't this whole, now there's more of a whole like studio path from, you know, intern to assistant to engineer. And I guess that existed back in the day, but there wasn't all these sound engineering schools pumping out all these people trying to get into these gigs. So it was a little less competitive. Still, you know, not easy. No one was right about to give me a gig for nothing, you know.
You still got to put the time in and do quality work. So at what point did you feel that it went from, you know, intern to assistant producer or producer? Was it a particular project that you worked on? Was it an album or a song that you worked on as an intern and someone heard it and go, wow, who did that? It's amazing. I want them to work on my album. Like, how did it transition from that intern into, you know, a producer, engineer?
Yeah, I mean, I wish it was as idyllic as that. But the reality was that, you know, I was being a poor immigrant. I was, you know, willing to work for free. And I just worked for free until I got to a breaking point of like, okay, guys, you need to pay me. And I was, by that time, you know, I'd got my skills up and I was pretty decent at what I did. So it was kind of like, okay, then, you know, all right, fine, I guess we have to pay you. But the transition from... but that was only, so at that first label, the cool thing about that was the producers and writers that would come through to work with the artists. And so it was really those connections that got me to the next level, because it was like those producers saying, okay, this guy knows what he's doing, and then, calling me up. So it's all word of mouth. So,
okay. So, what advice then would you give to, someone that's in the similar situation that you were, 17, 18 years ago? Would you suggest they establish a reputation with, talent or record companies, managers, producers to kind of establish themselves? Or is it good to, establish a reputation with everyone across the board?
Yeah, I would say across the board. I would just say, just remember that your work is going to speak for you, quality of your work, not your marketing. A lot of musicians spend 95% of their time on getting new followers and 5% on actually on their music. And I was kind of the opposite. I still am the opposite these days. Talent sometimes it, it doesn't, the talent doesn't have that as much say as you might think. Sometimes it is, because I work with Bieber since he started, and now, and Bieber has for a long time, like, controlled his own career and controlled who he works with and everything like that. To a new artist that's not so established like him, they're not, usually in control so much. A new artist might tell their label, I really like working with that guy. And then the label might say, no, he's too expensive, so we only use him for the singles or something like that. So, it's an all-round approach, I think. Wearing different hats and being a good vocal producer here, but being a good businessman, elsewhere, and understanding budgets and working your way into a project that, being flexible with your rate and stuff. If the budget is not a Bieber budget, then don't try and charge Bieber rates, stuff like that.
Right. So the best advice would be, get involved in as many different projects as you possibly can, and do a good job on those projects, and do the absolute best you can, and develop a strong portfolio of really good work, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And be personable and pleasant to be around when you are working too, because you're often cooped up in a studio with another dude, and you just don't want to, you want to be clean and all the rest, everything, because no one wants to get cooped up in a studio with someone who hasn't brushed their teeth. So, it's personal presentation and appearance and hygiene and all that stuff too.
Absolutely. And then Bieber connection come about? Was it a referral? Was it another project that you'd worked on? And how did that come into play?
So like I mentioned, I was working with Tricky Stewart, and we did a lot of good projects, and he produced Baby. So I tuned that, and that was how the connection was made. So then I did Baby, and then did his next few albums, and all the albums since. I think I've done, engineered probably nearly every single song that he's done. There's a couple of singles that I didn't, but yeah.
That's cool. It's a great client to have. the name Tech, how did that come about?
Just because I was, the technical one.
Right. You were the tech guy. Was it one particular person that came up with that name, or was like, this is it, I'm going to call myself Tech from now on?
It was, you're talking back to when I was a teenager, but late teenager, okay. But it was definitely self propelled too, because sometimes you got to put your foot out there and say, this is who I'm going to be and this is what I'm going to do, and you sort of just got to do it. So I'm not going to pretend that I didn't have something to do with it as well, but I'm not ashamed of that. That's just sometimes you got to do what you got to do.
You do, absolutely. Now, on your side, it seems like you're focused a lot on vocal production. Is that primarily what you do? I mean, at what stage of the song production do you work on? Do you just get the rough mix and then you put the vocals in and produce the vocals, or do you do full production from scratch as well?
Yeah, to different people, the different clients that do different things. Some I mix, some I do vocal production, but yeah, I am known as a vocal producer. And so in vocal production, you'll get the song. It could be at any stage. It could be very basic. It could have all the harmonies already. The songwriter might have written all the harmonies and the ad-libs, or it might have none of that. It might just be a single lead. And depending on the artist, you know, you got to adapt it for them. So, yeah, whether it's writing harmonies and writing ad-libs for them to sing, you know, and recording, what I'll do is I'll record those parts and then, you know, have the artist sing it. So I'll sing it myself, even though I'm not a great singer, but I can sing it well enough to illustrate. So, but yeah, it depends on the artist, of course. Like, you're not going to, you know, figure out a nice five-part harmony for an artist that wouldn't do that. So it's partly a creative in that way. And then the second part of it is really getting the vocalist to deliver that on tape. So whether it's, you know, getting them to, a lot of times, to be honest, it's about the confidence of the artist, and it's building up their confidence and getting them comfortable and getting them to sing what you want and how you want them to sing it. And then, and then the third stage would be bringing it all together, comping it, tuning it, and delivering. Like, you need to deliver to the label a song that sounds like 99% the way there, even before it goes to mix. And then mixing, you know, if you've done a good job of vocal production, there's not going to be much of a difference between the mix that I deliver and the final mix. So a lot of the biggest songs that I've done that I vocal produced that I didn't mix, I would say a layman probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference between my mix and the final mix, mastered mix. A professional would. But it's about getting that perspective and you know, like saying, okay, this is how the vocal should be for this song. And, you know, it's, like I said, it's very fine details and stuff, but that's your job as a...
So how do you approach the vocal production process when you listen to a song? You say, you know, this sounds great, but I think there, you know, there may be a five-part harmony here and we should maybe try different vocalists. Maybe we need to get a female harmony in there. I mean, how do you kind of go through that, you know, creative process of figuring out how the best vocal production should be produced?
Yeah, the first process is really learning the song and learning... I spend it, like, I'll always get the song if I can a day before. I mean, something like I did Starving for Haley Steinfeld, and I got that song while I was in the studio and Zed was there and he played a Starving and was like, do you want to do this song? And so that was like instant. So I had to like write the harmonies on the spot for that and do that. But if I can, I will get the song a day before and really learn the song, because there's always going to be some tiny little details that the songwriter has done. And often songwriters are the best singers because they do these little things, these little, whatever it is, that give that song like a vibe and give the song it just that personality and that swag. I don't know how else to describe it, but there's going to be little things that the songwriter's done. And so it's about like learning what that is, because if you don't vocal produce it well and it gets back to the label and they're like, yeah, I don't know, I like the demo better, it means you haven't sort of captured the essence of what the demo singer was really trying to do. So first, really learning the song, finding out how you can improve it. Like, maybe you can't improve it. Maybe the best way to get the best result for that song is just to relay the emotion of the songwriter and the way they did it and not add anything. Or maybe the best thing is, you know, the best approach is, okay, well, this would sound amazing with like really thick harmonies, maybe in the second and third chorus, but not the first. And so I learn the song and I'll sing those harmonies down and tune them all up. I'm a pretty terrible singer. And then when I'm in with the artist, I can just be like, quick, okay, sing this part, and I'll just solo that harmony without the lead. So it's very easy for them to hear the note. And then, you know, like I said, again, even after they've done, after they've gone, like a song will probably take 2 or 3 hours to record at the most, but it's going to be 2 or 3 days of me going through every take and comping it together. And you know, comping is where you might have 20 tracks of the verse, and you might use, you know, a word from track three, from take three, and then you might use a word from the fifth track, and you put it all together. It might be a whole phrase from one track, whatever it is. But you put it, right, you comp it all together to get a great performance from all these little pieces. And then, and once it's comped, then you can tune it and, and then tuning it and mixing it and et cetera.
Sure. So what's the difference then between auto-tune and vocal tune? And how do you figure out which one's going to be needed?
Well, so auto-tune and Melodyne is a better... So auto-tune is automatic. You put it on the track and you tell it what key it's in, and it, so it locks the note to the nearest note. So if you're in a very simple example, if you're in C major and, you know, this, the notes are just all the white notes of the keyboard, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, A, B. So if that's all the white notes in, you know, in C major. And so if someone's singing, they're a little bit sharp of the C, but they're not, they're sharp, but they're still closer to the C than they are to the D, then auto-tune will pull it back down to the C. So auto-tune basically just locks it in key. And when you turn up the retune speed, is when you turn it all the way up to zero, is where you get the T-Pain effect, where it locks to the note and gives it that auto-tuney type thing. So then, so that's one way of doing it. The other way is Melodyne, where in Melodyne, you actually import the vocal into Melodyne and you manually tune it. So you just say, okay, this note needs to go here and this note needs to go there. So you chop it up and basically tune it all, and, you know, and tune it. So it's far superior. There's just no, there's no substitute for doing it by hand like that versus just chucking auto-tune on. So that's why, because there's subtle things that, like in Melodyne, for instance, you can leave vibrato untouched, whereas auto-tune, when it hears vibrato, it's often going to, as the note modulates and goes up, auto-tune will think it's going to the next note, so it'll pull it up, and then the vibrato comes down and it goes to the other note, and auto-tune will try and pull it down. So what can happen to vibrato and auto-tune, and then, by the way, there's a button that you can press that ignores vibrato, but it doesn't work that great. But so the auto-tune can pull on the vibrato and make a nice smooth vibrato into this kind of thing. And whereas if you're in Melodyne, you can tune what you need, but you can leave the vibrato untouched, or you can tune it, or if you think the vibrato is sharp, you can, you know, often people go sharp on the vibrato, you can pull it down, stuff like that. And then you can also leave the transients untouched, and you can leave the parts that you don't want to be tuned, you can leave them natural. So if you consider something like, if you think back to like a Nirvana song, Kurt Cobain singing, he never sung out of tune. If he did, it would sound awful and we wouldn't listen to it. But what he would often do is this sort of drawl where he would take a long time to get up to the note. But so it might be, but when he hits the note, he's right on the note. And otherwise it would just sound terrible. So if he was around today and he was trying to sing the auto-tune, that if he did a bend, it would just go bing and go straight to the note. Now, if you're in Melodyne and you're tuning it, you can leave that stuff untouched and just tune like sort of the meat of the note and leave, you know, anything surrounding it in its natural state, which gives it the natural sound. And also you can also tune things harder in certain places and while keeping stuff natural. So yeah, it's a whole thing. There's also something to be said to in Melodyne where you can tune vocals together so that they move together. If you're just chucking auto-tune on and you have, because usually in say a pop chorus you'll have 5 stacks of the lead melody, so you'll have the lead vocal and then you'll have 4 stacks doing the same thing, exact same thing, and they'll be panned like hard left right. So there's 5 vocals doing the exact same thing, and it's supposed to sound as one vocal, and that's how you get that wide sort of chorus effect in pop vocals. Now, if you have auto-tune on, each track might be in tune, but they might not be moving together to the same notes together. So in Melodyne, you can import all the vocals of that, say, chorus, and you can tune them so they all move together. And that's how you get that kind of singular voice type sound.
Sounds like a fairly intricate process. And I guess there must be a really fine line when you're producing this. You're like, okay, you know, how much tuning do I need to do? Am I doing too much tuning? Is it starting to sound unnatural? You know, right. Do I want to keep as much of the, you know, tune as natural as possible? It must get to a certain point where you're like, this is too much. You know, how do you kind of establish that? Do you have a second set of ears listening to it, or you just kind of have a break and come back to it? You know, how do you avoid falling down the tune rabbit hole, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, well, whenever I'm tuning a vocal, it's completely dry. There's no reverb or delay on it or anything, so I'm just hearing the vocal soloed. And in that state, you can hear as you go through it. You know, you tune a part, and does it sound, if it had to be moved too far, does it sound artificial or what? So I think it's kind of, it's definitely a thing that you do as you go down, but it's also, like you said, like taking a break is actually good. I'll sort of tune something, and then I'll flip over to something else, and then I'll have a listen again. And, you know, on fresh ears, you do say, okay, that does sound a little funky there. I'll go back. With Melodyne, you can pretty much avoid, you can hear those artificial, what's the word for it, artifacts coming in. You know, you can sort of mitigate away from them.
Cool, awesome. Okay, and then as far as the decision process goes, I know, you know, some artists would likely have a say in how it's produced, and I imagine record companies and producers too. You know, how do you get to a happy medium? If the producer comes back, the record company comes back and say, oh, we don't like it. We'd prefer you did this and that, but the artist is like, oh, I don't want to do that. It's like, do those kinds of situations come up a lot, and how do they generally get resolved?
It really depends on the power dynamic of the label versus the artist. So, like an established artist, like I said, like with Bieber, it's going to be his call. And I think the record label supports him on that too. It's kind of like he knows what he's been doing it for so long, he knows what he's doing. So there would never really be a dispute where the label's like, no, I want it like that, and Justin's like, no, I want it like that. It just go Justin's way. If it's a new artist, I mean, it really depends on, you know, who they are it can be a tough one, but like you tend to find that when you do a good job that everyone's happy, because there's kind of only, there's often only really one right way to do it, which sounds crazy for a song, but I've found that the better I get, the less revisions. Like probably the last 10 songs I've done, I probably haven't gone past the second revision, and most of them I get it on the first try. And so, usually revisions will be if something's like out of time or something's rushing or too late or, it doesn't sound great. But if you do a good job and it sounds great, like people won't really have much to comment on.
Yeah, I guess you kind of get used to how a person works, or you understand, you know, what a particular manager or record company likes, and you understand how a particular artist sings and what sounds good in their vocal track, and you kind of start getting used to those formulas, and I guess over time, you know, the process becomes quicker, right?
Yeah, exactly. And getting back to what I was saying before, that usually it's any comments to do with it's not getting the vibe of the demo, because you have to remember that A&Rs and record companies, people, they don't know or care about technical details and this and that. They just want their artist to be seen. They love that song. They've probably been listening to it for a month straight, and they're like, I can't wait to get my artist on it. And then if you take too many liberties and you change it too much, or you don't really nail, like I said, what it was that was special about the demo, that's when you'll get a comment like, no, I don't really like this, you know.
Right. It sounds like a different song altogether, or a different vibe, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. Cool. And then let's talk a little bit about your current studio and the setup. I know you've recently put together your own production studio. Is that, again, generally set up for vocal production, or are you able to record full bands? What exactly can you do in your studio?
Yeah, it's pretty small. I have done drums in here, but only for a band that I was working with that I was producing. So it's mainly vocals, but that's, you know, mainly my work is vocals and vocal production. So it's a good place. I mean, I can do guitars and, you know, have a few keyboards and stuff like that. It's perfect for me and for what I do. And, you know, I have a lot of outboard gear and analog gear that I mix through and it's a good space.
Cool. You occasionally and do you get invited to you know, produce and mix at other studios as well for different artists and albums, or is everything that you do done in your own studio?
Yeah, most of it I do it here in my studio. It just depends on the artist. Like if an artist has a favorite studio and they want to do their album there, then you just, you know, you go there. So, but I tend to, if I'm in LA, I'm here. Sometimes, which hasn't been recently, but if I travel, well, a couple of months ago, I was in Miami for J-Lo, because she's out there. So, that was fun. So, go out there, but it really just depends on what the artist wants to do.
Right, right. Very cool. And what are you working on currently, and what's coming up? Anything new and exciting that you're working on that you'd like to let us know about?
One thing exciting, but I can't say it, but a song came out, which is pretty cool, which is Stuck on You, which is Justin and Ariana Grande.
Okay.
And then, upcoming stuff, I don't know, the stuff, yeah, it's kind of like it just shows up, you know, I did it. Well, the problem is I can't say what I've done that hasn't come out yet.
But
working with, you know, all the usual people, and Justin Bieber and Asher Angel is a cool new artist that I've been working with who signed to Hitco. And then my artist as well, Black Summer, who's super talented young kid. He's 17, but his tracks are just insane. I could never do what he does at his age. I didn't even know if I could if I could do it when I was 10 years older than him. So I don't know. He's a talented dude. So. Yeah.
Sounds good. I'll have to check him out. Is he on YouTube, Vimeo, or the usual channels?
Yeah, he's on YouTube. If you search for a young producer, he's the top top hit on there, because he was unearthed by Triple J when he was 11. And so he sort of got some national attention. And then everyone, all the comments, like three quarters of the comments are like how he's, you know, it's fake. They think I produce the songs and do the tracks, which is insane. But anyway, so we had this backlash saying, all these comments saying is ghost producing, blah, blah, blah. So we eventually started, we weren't worried about it at first, but it sort of got so invasive that we were like, okay, we need to do something about it. So we started streaming where he would just create tracks from scratch and stream tracks. And now everyone's like, oh crap, I guess you were producing it all along. And there's been a lot of apologies and stuff, and a lot of kids saying, which has been cool, because they've actually been, a lot of these kids have been kind of humble with it. Like, oh, sorry, man, I accuse you of being ghost producer, but I see you actually do the work. So so it's turning around. It's just interesting to see that the dynamic where the haters actually kind of had some legit effect, even though at first we were like, oh well, it's not true, so I'm not going to worry about it, but their kind of voices became so prevalent that I think it did actually have an effect. So you live, you learn. Such as the internet, such as the jealousy.
Exactly. A lot of haters out there, man, a lot of haters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That comes with the industry, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this has been really cool, man. I've enjoyed this conversation. There's been a lot of cool information, learning how, you know, your process works and some of the artists that, you know, you've been involved in. It's been really great. I've known, we've been in touch for a long time. You know, I know we did your website.
Yeah.
Oh, God, what was that? Probably 10, 12 years ago now.
I think we did bump into
each other one time. It was at an Australian football grand final, if I recall correctly. So yeah, it's good to catch up and find out what you've been working on. It sounds like you've been busy and you've been doing some great work. So good job. Always good to see a fellow Aussie doing well in LA.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So any of your listeners wanted to search Tech, you can do so online through his website, techzenmusic.com. You can also find Tech, I believe you're on social media as well. You're on, Tumblr, Facebook?
What is Tumblr? No, it's, I'm pretty much just, well, actually, I'm not on social media all that much, to be honest. I don't know. It kind of annoys me, but I post every so often, but it's Tech Zen Music is on Instagram and Facebook and stuff.
We'll have to get some of these social media icons updated for you down here. I thought this looked like a Tumblr icon, but it is a Twitter. So I see you've got Twitter, Facebook. Google Plus is gone, so you should probably get rid of that. and you said Instagram. You're on Instagram now?
Yep.
Cool. Well, we should get that icon added to your site so people can visit you. And I noticed that my web design link right at the bottom there is pointing to my old website, proflashdesign.com. We'll have to get that one updated as well.
Yeah. I do neglect my online presence a little bit, but like I said, I'm sort of more focused on doing the work, and people who need to know what I do, which is cool. So don't worry too much about the online stuff, but I know I gotta keep it up. Just get lazy.
Yeah, and I think it's a good way for you to promote some of your, more personal projects and some of the, artists that you're working with closely and managing. So
True.
Something you could do, get a page set up for your management or production work, and that way people can get a bit more familiar with you and the artists that you're working with.
Yeah, true.
All right, Chris, I won't take up too much more of your time. I know you're a busy man, but thanks again for joining us today on the podcast. Hopefully we can do this again some point in the future. Maybe we'll come into your studio and working on a track or something. But, I'd love to do it again sometime soon.
Sounds good.
All right, mate. Chris, thanks again. You stay safe. Be good, and all the best.
All right, you too. Cheers, mate.